So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the first day of the class. As I know, some people were disappointed that I'm not teaching on Zoom this time. So, I promised them I will get my lessons audio taped on my phone so that later on they can share them whenever they meet. Because there's no way to share them online as well because of heavy files. So, however, so today, the first day, as you know, the topic, this class is going to be kind of perpetual. There's no set time limit. So, we will continue for a few weeks, every Thursday from 7 to 8:30. And then, after a few weeks, we will take a break and then we'll gather again. Because I will have to make some quick trips to USA and Canada. And so then we will continue. And this is an open-ended course, in other words, because you are, while we discuss certain chosen themes, and you are free to ask questions not really pertaining to what we discuss in class. You are free to ask any questions, because why? Your questions are utmost importance to me, because your questions will put me on certain direction that I wouldn't even think about. So that always your questions would put me on a different on different directions, and those directions would help us to build up new themes so that we can continue the class. So this is why this is a free open-ended class. And so the we put the title for this course as Successive Themes in the Buddha Dhamma rather than Buddhism. Buddha Dhamma is a standard term that we use because Buddha Dhamma is a very Buddhism is a very corrupt term. When you say Buddhism, it includes culture, history, philosophy, religion, faith, all that. Whereas when you say Buddha Dhamma, its scope is quite limited. So it is limited to the original teachings of the Buddha. So the source language the only source language we would be using for this course is Pali. Pali is the language in which the earliest or the most authentic teachings of the Buddha are preserved. So every time we meet up, we will get a few key terms that would contribute towards building up a theme. Not too many words. And it's better to list these words because we will come across these terms again and again. And we would always give priority to explaining the etymology of those terms. Because most of the time, we happen to read different English translations of the original terms. Original terms at times are translations are at times misleading. And then so the translation sometimes even although scholars or translators or teachers are free to translate terms in order to mean in order to put the Buddha Dhamma in different context. At the same time, they are not supposed to distort. It's always to be on the safe side, you would always start with the etymology. So every time I would bring you some key terms with etymology. So that's when you read teachings or the books or articles or on Buddha Dhamma, so then you'll be able to refer to those. Terms back and forth. So that's how we're going to do this. So today's theme is awakening or spiritual enlightenment. Enlightenment. For this theme, we have chosen four Pali terms. I'm yet to name the Pali words actually, but I'm still list only listed the roots. The first root is bud. Second root is dru, pronounced dru. Like you say dru, here dru. And third word is some hur, but you don't have to worry about the pronunciation because you're going to get the actual terms. And the last one is Maggapala. Now, the root, the word Buddha, comes from the root Buddha. That's the root. Buddha comes from the root Buddha. B-U-D-H, Buddha. That's the root. So I'm also pronouncing the word so that those who listen to the audio file, they should be able to know the spelling. So the first root is Buddha, B-U-D-H. So the word Buddha comes from Buddha, from the root Buddha. And second root is Dhru. That's D-H-R with diacritical mark dot underneath R. Dhru. So Dhru. Once again, it's D-H-R with diacritical mark dot underneath R. Why we are using these diacritics is that's an international Pali alphabet. So you can refer to when you read the Pali canonical books here, so that all the canonical books include the international Pali alphabet that is created by Pali Text Society London, PTS London. So they have the they have published the most prestigious or the most accurate that's one of the earliest translation of the Pali canon. So all these diacritic marks we use as in accordance with the international Pali alphabet created by Pali Text Society, UK, London. So that's PTS. And the third root is sam, S-A-M, the diacritical mark dot underneath M, pronounced like in NG, singing, going, running. That's how you pronounce NG. Plus HR, pronounced HRO, that's diacritic mark dot underneath H, HRO. Some HRO. Some HRO. So the word Dhamma comes from the root Dhru. Dhamma, Dhru. And then the word Sangha comes from the root Sam plus Huru. Later I will explain them one by one again. Maggapala, we'll talk about that later on. Now, once again, we are using four key terms today. Buddha, that is derived from the root Buddha, and Dhamma, which is derived from the root Dhru, and the Sangha, which is derived from Sam plus Huru, and Maggapala. M-A-G-G-A, Magga dash, P-H-A-L-A, Pala. You can write Maggapala as a one word, or you can separate it by a hyphen, by a dash. So Maggapala, M-A-G-G-A, Magga, P-H-A, Pala. Maggapala. Now, these are the key words. Now we can continue the discussion. Interrupt me anytime to ask questions. When you ask me a question, I will repeat the question so that I can get it I need to record it, right? Make sure I have to use, okay, from time to time I have to check. Now, so today's theme is awakening / spiritual enlightenment. Now, enlightenment is a very tricky word. It has different meanings. When you talk about the Renaissance of Greek and Roman culture, arts, and they are also a period of enlightenment period. So, and then in arts and architecture, in politics, arts and architecture, we widely use the word enlightenment. In order to distinguish enlightenment as used as a technical terms in the Buddha Dhamma, we may use the word spiritual enlightenment. However, A better term is awakening. That is the exact translation of that comes from also the word awakening also comes from the root Buddha that's going to discuss now. So let's continue like 20 minutes or so, then we will like break for questions. Or if a question is very critical, please raise your hand right away, then I will stop my talking and answer the question instead. So that then you continue again. So now, now in the Buddha's teaching or the Buddha Dhamma has an aspect of philosophy and religion. Over time, his teaching has gone through transformation in different geographical regions. So as a result, there have come into being what is called Buddhisms. Academics use that word a lot. Usually in general English, in conversational English, we don't use isms in, we don't use the word Buddhisms because there's one word. But nowadays there are different, there's a multitude of Buddhisms. Northern Buddhism, which is Mahayana Buddhism, that started from India and went through Tibet, China, Far East Asia, South Korea, Japan, and ended up in Northern Vietnam. And Southern Buddhism, even though I don't personally agree with these terms, but in academia, I don't know, in academia I use those terms. And Southern Buddhism is the Buddhism that went to Sri Lanka, from where it got spread, it got introduced to so parts of Bangladesh, and then so Southeast Asia, including Thailand, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam. By the time two Buddhism met in Vietnam, they had they were like two different religions. So they even to this date, Vietnam is the only country in the world where both Buddhisms flourish the same to the same extent in South Vietnam, Mahayana Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism, and also in Tibet, and in Tibet people practice what is called Lama Buddhism, Diamond Buddhism. So it is also practiced in Mongolia and Inner Mongolia and in Russia and Bhutan. So that is why we avoid the word, avoid the use of the word Buddhism, because it's a very tricky, misleading political term, Buddhism. So that's why when we use the word Buddha Dhamma, not even Dharma, so it is totally based on the Pali Canon. Now, that's with that simple clarification, let's start with the first word, now awakening. As I said, Buddhism is not a religion, nor is it a philosophy, but a way of life. All the teachings are based on based on our mind. Buddha doesn't talk about anything when it comes to spiritual enlightenment or awakening. Buddha never talks about anything outside of the mind. It's everything within the mind. Now, even the highest, the salvation or the summum bonum as we expect in religion, as it is taught in Buddhism, is Nirvana. But Nirvana is not a cosmic place. It's not a cosmic reality. It's not a cosmic place. It is a cognitive place. So we use the word cognitive instead of cosmic. Remember that dichotomy. So it's not a cosmic reality, it's a cognitive reality. So Nirvana is the highest level of our cognition, our cognitive transformation. So it is a definitely, in other words, it's a mental transformation. It has nothing to do with the heavens. Even though in Buddhist cosmology, you talk about hells, heavens, different dimensions of life in the universe, different, and then Brahma world, higher divine worlds and all that. But all those places are also, until you attain Nirvana, you may have to get reborn into those realms, in those lokas, in those worlds. But still, you only get qualified when you transform your mind to a certain extent. When you achieve certain cognitive transformation, and so that there will be a, so that you should be able to get reborn into those realms. But by wishful thinking, you can get there. So, but however, in the Buddha Dhamma, what is highly recommended is Nirvana, or the salvation. Why? When you are focused on Nirvana, you will automatically get all the other kind of worldly comfort, maybe in heaven, maybe in the higher heavens, maybe back in the human realm, different realms. So, and people are, followers are highly discouraged to think about heaven, the heavens. Whenever people think about the heavens, they get anxious. So you become anxious when you think about heaven. There's no guarantee that you get there, and that you don't know whether or not you make it. Whereas when you focus on Nirvana, so that in Nirvana, that you are focused on Nirvana means you are not going to acquire anything for yourself. You are doing the opposite. You train yourself to let go of everything. So letting go versus instead of acquiring. You don't do any. The only wish is to let go of things. Now, if we use an analogy, it is like the golden palace. There's a palace made of gold and diamonds, embedded. All the walls, outer inner walls are embedded with different diamonds. It's a golden palace with whose walls are all of embedded with diamonds. And there are a few doors. It's like a circular building. There are different doors to enter. There are different entrances. And so it is made in, it contains three layers, the outermost layer, middle layer, and inner layer, and different layers. The outermost layer is full of furniture, all valuables, the interior design, the interior of the first layer, the outermost layer, is so beautiful. It is it's breathtakingly beautiful, full of so many valuable things. When you go to the furniture as well, when you go to the second layer, it doesn't have any furniture, but there are some lot of jewelries inside the second layer. And when you go into the third layer, and now you are curious, you might think that if the second layer is filled with more valuable things, the innermost layer, the third layer, chamber, the inner chamber would be filled with the most valuable things in the world. When you enter the third layer, to your surprise, to your bewilderment, it's totally empty. There's nothing inside the innermost chamber. There's nothing inside. That's how Nirvana, that's one analogy of Nirvana. So, but you might get disappointed when to enter the inner chamber. Why? Because you conceptually you expect to have more valuable things, the more the inner, more when you go inner and inner inwards, when you go inwards, and you expect to get more valuable things, but it doesn't happen. The innermost chamber is totally empty. Now this disappoints a lot of people. Why? Because we always define Nirvana in terms of our worldly attachments. So we are made of attachments. Our identity is attachment. So even though I promise that I will only use for these, word, but I think everyone is familiar with another Pali word or Sanskrit word that you have used a lot. So in part, we are sentient beings. We are so we are sattvas. In Pali, we are satta. S-A-T-T-A, satta. Satta. So, pardon, but I would, sometime I may happen to use certain words, but they are not keywords. These are the only keywords. Satta. S-A-T-T-A, satta. Satta is the Pali word. Sat, in Sanskrit, it's called sattva. S-A-T-T-V-A, sattva. In other Indian languages, we call it sattva. Satta means sentient beings. So I am a sattva, every one of you are sattva. All beings, living beings are sattvas. They are sattas. Now, sattva literally means attachment. If I am a sentient, if and when, of course I am a sentient being. So what is my identity? My identity is attachment. I can't talk about my identity without referring to attachment. So it is my, when I define myself, I would talk about my attachment. Okay, this is my name. I would proudly say I'm a monk. Oh, I have attachment to my monkhood. And I would talk about my education, another attachment. My friends, where I live. So all those words imply my attachment. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't worry about that. It's quite natural. Attachments are natural, once again. According to the Buddha Dhamma, attachments are natural. And I'm always being asked here, when a lot of, most of the most frequently asked questions, one of the FAQs is whether attachments are bad. Attachments become good or bad based on your purpose of life. For example, as a monk, I cannot go for parties. I don't go to pubs, clubs. Whereas you lay people can go. If I ask you not to go, I'm wrong. Why? I'm not asking. I'm asking you to do something that I'm not supposed to ask you. Why? As a monk, I'm not supposed to go to those places. As a layperson, you are free to go. Even if you are free to go, you are not supposed to hit anyone or get into trouble. So, and then you are, lay people are free to enjoy a lot more things than a monk like me. I'm just comparing myself with you, lay people. But however, which regardless of our positions, we need to have self-imposed limits. Self-imposed limitations. When all those limitations are necessarily ethical and legal. When you don't violate the set ethical and legal limits, you are free to enjoy anything. And you are not supposed to hurt anyone, even yourself, for the sake of attachment. If you are addicted to drugs, and then you cut yourself. Certain people, some certain addicts do that. You have no right to harm yourself. You have no right to take your own life, suicide. So because your life is precious, you need to respect yourself. So that some people wrongfully believe that they have a right to do anything to their body, anything to themselves, which is wrong. Even in the eyes of general legal, in the eyes of justice systems across the world, suicide is unethical, of course unlawful. So that is when somebody, in case somebody is deemed to be thinking about suicide, and sometimes the legal authorities can put you on suicide watch. Right? People have to face that. So those are about attachments. But based on our purpose of life, we need to see the limits of our attachments. And they should be covered with the set by accepted legal and ethical norms. Now, awakening. Now, the Pali word for awakening, it is interrelated with the word Buddha. Now why we start with the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha here? Because this is the first part of the, when you talk about the scope of awakening, scope of enlightenment. So the scope here means it's everything is within. You may have come across that statement, a Buddhist statement. Everything is within. Nothing is without. Everything is within. Nothing is without. So everything is internalized, if I use an academic word. Now, Nirvana has no cosmic connection. In Buddhism, even salvation is internalized. It's an internal process. As I said, it's a cognitive process, not a cosmic process. Right? Unlike in theistic religions. And where is Nirvana? Where is awakening? Awakening is achieved within. Now, when you become an enlightened person, what will happen to your physical body? You will remain the same. You will go through, you won't stop aging, you won't stop, you wouldn't be able to get, prevent illness, sickness, you wouldn't be able to prevent aging, you wouldn't be able to prevent death. But awakening or spiritual enlightenment is completely, it is a mental thing. It is a mental state. Now, what happens to awakening when somebody passes away? Upon death, what will happen to someone's enlightenment? So those are the tricky questions, right? Sometimes we don't think about them. I always, those simple but tricky questions. What will happen to your Nirvana, if I use the standard word? Now, you hear with reference to, and you hear from the Buddhist teachings that upon death, an enlightened person never comes back to birth. And he ends his existence, never comes back to birth. Why doesn't he come back? When someone dies as an enlightened person, when somebody dies, the death of an enlightened person, they never come back to birth. Because they have completely stopped their rebirth. So why doesn't he get reborn again? Because they get their consciousness totally dissolved. There's nothing going for the creation, nothing from the mind. Consciousness is going to create another form of existence for that person. Then what will happen to Nirvana, to his Nirvana? It's no more then. Completely gone. That is what some people don't like to hear. I know some of Bhante, don't tell me that. I don't like that type of Nirvana, please. Please stop. Then I would say, okay, then go to a pub and have a drink and enjoy. Oh, no, I mean, don't say that. I mean, I already said that. So that's how Nirvana is. Now, always, the value of awakening is understood with reference to our empirical existence, with reference to our existence, based on our sensory experience. Always, the value of Nirvana is seen in comparison with our sensory experience. Now, however blissful, however pleasant an experience is, you can retain that experience forever. You get it overridden by other experiences that you create. Now, the only thing you can accept that you can recall your experience, recall the memories of that pleasant experience, and you can simply relive that. But that's not the actual experience again, because it is simply a memory. Because when you relive that experience, you don't involve your physical body. If you actualize your experience again, when you repeat the same thing again, let's say you had some good food that you had never had before yesterday, and today you close your eyes and think about, yummy, that's the best food in the world. Do you actually experience that again? No. You are simply recalling, you are simply rekindling, you are simply rekindling your experience. So unless you repeat that, sometimes people wake up in the middle of the night and get into their car and may see the public transport and see whether there are shops, restaurants available, right? Like 2-3 hours after midnight. I know some of my friends do that because they couldn't stop their cravings, attachment. And they would, even one of my friends got into a car accident and he got permanently paralyzed because of attachment for a drink. He didn't have anything in his home for a drink. Now he's permanently paralyzed. Now he lives with that. Now, so that is when we need to, I always tell him, now we accept himself that she should have waited until the morning. But he was not going to die. He said, Bhante, there was no necessity for me to call 911, because in 911 means he lives in America. But I should have waited. I think stupid me. I couldn't control my attachment. So that's what it happened to me. And he told me maybe my karma. I said, okay, please don't put the blame on karma. Everything is not karma. Most things happen in our life because we are irresponsible. We don't behave in a responsible manner. So going back to enlightenment. So it is what will happen to somebody's enlightenment. For example, when Buddha Gautama passed away at the age of 80, what happened to his nirvana? It's a wrong question. So then he died, but he didn't. But conventionally we say Buddha went to nirvana. Of course, he achieved nirvana. There's no going. When did he saw nirvana? When did he see nirvana? If we still use the word going, to go, he went to nirvana at the age of 35, when he became enlightened. So he lived in nirvana. He lived in nirvana. If we have a conventional question, where did the Buddha live after his enlightenment? Or he spent most of his time, lifetime, the rest of his life in Jetavanarama, Jeta Grove Monastery, or Pubbarama, Eastern Monastery. Or he would travel a lot. One rainy retreat you spend in the forest. And those are the answers. But spiritual answer is that for the next 45 years, Buddha would live in Nirvana. Because Nirvana, it is only in the Buddha Dhamma do you hear that salvation is a living experience. Have you ever thought about it? Nirvana is a living experience. It is not afterlife. So you achieve it when you are a living person. Again, some of my friends don't like to hear that. But in tradition, especially in Sri Lanka, when somebody is dead, we say that Nivan Sapa Labeva, may you attain the supreme bliss of Nirvana. That's what we say. And that is why we say that, why we make that wish for the departed ones. That ones is that if they had achieved Nirvana, they would have never died in a way that they would come back to suffering. They would have ended the cycle of suffering, samsara. So, and then what that implies is, try your best not to come back to suffering again. Achieve nirvana wherever you go, please, as soon as possible. So that's the implication. So it's a living experience. Now, Buddha, that comes to the root Buddha, B-U-D-H, Buddha, the root Buddha, literally means to awaken, to wake up. To awaken, to wake up. Wake up from what? to wake up from samsara. S-A-M-S-A-R-A, samsara. Samsara is an English word. Samsara. To wake up from samsara. What is samsara then? It is a cycle of successive births, deaths, and rebirths, deaths, births, rebirths, and it continues. It is a continuous cycle of existence that of which we come back in different life forms. Now, so every time, another key point here is, Buddha has talked about Nirvana only in a few places of his teachings. He has spent, I cannot say by percentage, if I use a percentage for convenience, he has talked about samsara like in 98.5% or maybe 99% of teachings talk about samsara. There's only 1% that talks about nirvana. Why is that? Once achieved, it's a moment. When you run a race, let's say you run a marathon, or maybe you run, I don't know, 100 meters, 200 meters, whatever the way you use it. Maybe you are a sprinter or a marathon runner, right? So now you are a sprinter, so that or a marathon, you run a race. Now, how long does it take you to cross the finish line? Let's say the marathon, it takes you 10 hours for the marathon. You run across the country. It's a cross-country marathon. Let's say you run for like 10 hours. With short breaks, maybe you can slow down. And then let's say it's a 10-hour run, 10-hour race. How long does it take you to cross the finish line? Maybe a few seconds, maybe one or 2 seconds only. Now, that finish line, the time that you take to cross the finish line, that is the time that takes you to achieve enlightenment. But the rest of the time, you run the race. You are in samsara striving to achieve that. Is that clear? So that is why Buddha has given, dedicated most of his teachings, like 99% of it, to describe what samsara is, what our existence is, how it looks like, how to deal with it, how painful it can be, how pleasant it can be, how unpleasant it can be. So, and he simply explains everything. And in so doing, he never uses auxiliary verbs like should and must, grammatically speaking. He never uses auxiliary verbs, should and must, except in the case of monastics like me. You should not upananda, you must not upananda, because this is my chosen path. I have to abide by monastic rules and regulation. That is the only place where Buddha has used should and must. Where in other teachings, he simply uses the word you would not, you may not, you might not. Those are the auxiliaries that he used, because there are no commandments or rules and regulations. There's no method in Buddhist spirit that regulates your spiritual behavior. There are, of course, training principles or precepts. You voluntarily undertake to observe them. And you go at your own pace. You do that in your own pace, go at your own speed. So Buddha is the one. Now, Buddha has different meaning. There are different kinds of Buddhas. Basically, there are three words, and I'm not going to write them down on the board because you can remember them. And also, in case you need the audio file, please let me know. I can airdrop if you have an iPhone. If you have another phone, I can use the Bluetooth. Now, when it comes to Buddha, means the one who is awakened, one who has woken up. We went too far by explaining from what Buddha awakens, right? This morning you woke up to a phone call. From what? From your dreams or from your sleep? You woke up from your dreams or from your sleep. Now, the entire samsara is considered a dream. Entire samsara. Why? Again, samsara, there's no single samsara that we all live in, like nirvana. I have my own samsara. You have your own samsara. Sometimes conventions say that we will meet again in samsara. But actually, what really happens is your samsara and my samsara will meet up again. That's what will happen. Your samsara and my samsara. Samsara is based on it is within your mind. It has nothing to do with the physical or the natural world. The natural world is the basis of samsara. We create, we enhance, we feed, we nurture the roots of our samsara from the data that we collect from the external world, physical world, by using our senses. Right? So you have your own samsara, I have my own samsara. When I end my own samsara, I will achieve my own nirvana. It's a different story that when I achieve nirvana, I wouldn't call it my nirvana. Why? Because there's no me there. Because I have no attachment to nirvana. But unfortunately, as we discussed yesterday, we have to use the word conventional terms. So we can use self terms of like wordings of selflessness. Like we can speak, describe like the Buddha does. The max you could do is you can talk, explain your experience in the first person. No, in the third person. For example, when Upananda says, he can say, instead, I am thirsty, you could say, Upananda is thirsty. In certain Buddhist cultures, people use that, especially in Burma, Myanmar and Thailand, especially in Myanmar. Sometimes they say, I am thirsty. Instead of I am thirsty, they say so and so. Bhante, this is why calling, why is on the way to see you. Why is so tired today? Because why have to go back and do more work? So you can just practice, but in your day-to-day conversations, you can use this word. But otherwise, people might think you are crazy. Right? You can use in wording now, but that's how you feel. That's how enlightened people would feel because they have their mindset. Their mind is free from attachments. So the three kinds of we usually talk, the term Buddha is also very corrupt because people use the word Buddha to mean different things. Like in certain countries, you can buy Buddha alcohol, Buddha rice. Everything is Buddha, even drinks. But Buddha means awakened. Sometimes people simply say, recently I called one of my friends in Idaho, USA. He said that Bhante, I found this particular expensive alcohol from Europe. When I got to safe, I feel okay. I never thought I would have Nirvana, my Nirvana, this soon. To him, it was awakening, like enlightenment. I didn't say a word. I said, okay, good for you. Good for you. It's good for you. Good for you. But then I told him, okay, finish the bottle and buy another one, another one, another one, take 10. And one day you will take a phone call and say, Bhante, you know what? I don't like it anymore. And I did something. I said, okay, but then, so you are fed up with your Nirvana then. So, but in the way, I like those wordings, that how people, but in the way, the good thing about those expressions are, when people experience something very unique, and they call it nirvanic, and the nirvana is not an adjective. There's no adjective called nirvanic, but people use that to describe their experience. You cannot say nirvanic experience because nirvana is the experience. So now, from time to time, a pioneering Buddha appears in the world. They are called, that's when they say the Buddha, that's called Sammasambuddha. SAMMA Samma, SAM Sam Buddha, Samma Sam Buddha. But for now, during this class, what we mean by the Buddha is the Buddha, meaning the pioneering Buddha, who appears in the world after a long after millennia. So the last known Buddha appeared in the world was the one 6th century BCE, 6th century in India, Buddha Gautama. There had been many other Buddhas before, but between the time during which a Buddha's teaching is available on earth is called Buddha realm. Buddha realm. Now, people in Buddhist traditions, in general Buddhist tradition, people believe that current Buddha Gautama's realm is 5,000 years long. And we are halfway through 26 plus 100 years. There are some 20 plus 24 plus 100 years to go. This is called a Buddha realm. Realm. I'm not going to use the Pali word for that, too many otherwise. So the Buddha realm means yes.
Recorded in sutras, or is it just
That
belief?
that's right. That's a good thing. It's not nowhere have I come across the mention in sutras. So that's the belief. So I don't know where the canonical. I'm still looking for that. I started looking for that maybe like 2 years ago. Maybe I just want to know whether it could be mentioned in the commentaries probably. Because there's a commentarial Buddhist, a commentarial Buddha Dhamma and a sub-commentarial Buddha Dhamma. What I mean, the Buddha Dhamma, the canonical Buddha Dhamma. Because commentaries and sub-commentaries could tell you a different story. That's why every time possible, I may at times refer to the commentaries and sub-commentaries, but I always, because as someone who has learned Pali, I always refer to the original teachings and see the etymology and define and see whether somebody has distorted the meaning and all that. So Buddha means the one who appears in the world after a long time. Maybe a Buddha appears once in millennia, if I use the conventional language. Now, he's called the pioneering Buddha. Why? He is the one who strives, he works on his own, he achieved awakening all by himself. All but there's no guru to lead him, to teach him. There's no guru for him. Because he himself has to remember when you read the biography of the Buddha, he studied under different teachers, but he wasn't happy. He wasn't happy, see that what his teachers taught as salvation was the highest kind of salvation that he could learn from other teachers was the four formless Brahma worlds. We will talk about them in the future. It's too early for us to do. The four formless Brahma worlds means when you through your mental absorptions, when you through your psychic power in meditation, you freeze your consciousness, you temporarily freeze your consciousness so that when upon your death you will be reborn in one of those four formless Brahma worlds. In those worlds you don't have a physical body. Your consciousness is reborn there. So that your consciousness will remain frozen for some time. And we will talk about later on, maybe next week, so because it's a long story, it requires two class times and two meetings to describe that. For now, the highest kind of salvation that he had learned from his gurus, teachers, was the frozen consciousness somewhere in the cosmos, in a different world. But remain it would remain when the consciousness loses its psychic ability, it will come back to the sensory world, the normal. It would come back to humanity, or it would be reborn into reborn as a into the body of a sentient being. So that he rejected that idea too. And what Buddha did was, and Buddha said, even the Brahman, even the Brahman is impermanent. Even those worlds are impermanent. So that is why Buddha created a lot of enemies because of that statement. Buddha said that nothing is permanent in the universe. Even gods are impermanent. They also have a lifespan. One day they will end their divine existence and they will come back to humanity, or they might even end up in animal realm. So that is when he said, no, the actual Nirvana is in our mind. We achieve that from within. It has nothing to do with the cosmic reality. It's not a cosmic thing. It's not a cosmic process. It's a cognitive process. So now that is the Buddha's teaching. So Buddhas appear in the world to teach that. So now it is very hard to convince, actually. So that's why he made that statement. He got a lot of enemies. Some even tried to kill him several times. So that is when, because people wouldn't like to hear that, because in our genes, genetically, we have theistic genes. Our primal ancestor, we no longer use the word primitive ancestor. I think it's politically incorrect. With the primal ancestors. Our primal ancestors believed in, divinity. And Buddha, so that we carry that theistic notion. So that's why, because of our genetically inherited belief, whenever, even atheists, even free thinkers, I have noticed that sometimes I tease free thinkers. I have a lot of free thinkers, friends who are free thinkers. They don't believe in any religion or anything. I have seen that one day I was sipping coffee in the cold morning at Piccadilly Circus with some of my friends. And then one of the friends, and he was worried about his mom's health. He, all of a sudden, he looked up to the sky, I don't know how to help her. Then immediately I said, oh, thank you for your prayers. Please let me join a prayer. But I mean, you are looking up the sky, right? Yes. So because you are praying, because you need help to deal with, because you are deeply worried about your mother's health. Then he said to me, Bante, because you are my best friend, I don't feel offended. But I said, even if you get offended, I meant to say that. I said, I don't care that you got offended, because it's so very close. We are very close friends. Yes. Then I said, so that is called faith. I told him. Then thereafter he accepted that. Then he came up with a different definition of his free thinking. Well, I don't stick to any organized religion. I said, me neither. I said, but you are a monk. You are a Buddhist. Well, traditionally I'm a Buddhist monk, but if I look into the true Buddha Dhamma, it is not dogmatic. Some of my American friends always say, Bante, some Buddhist people believe in Buddha dogma instead of Buddha Dhamma. Not Buddha Dhamma, but Buddha dogma. So, and Buddha was against dogmatism. It's not dogmatic. So he simply, Buddha simply, the awakened one, Buddha simply explains the reality of the mind. He doesn't, in Buddha Dhamma, Buddha doesn't encourage you to get anything, plant anything anew into your mind. Not externally exported beliefs, or the exported, the belief exported from outside sources. You simply understand, you define your mind, how it functions, and do everything possible to fix innate problems that you were born with. There is fixing rather than importing or exporting, but there is letting go. And then what happens when you let go of certain negativities? Do you plan something anew? No. You identify innate positive mental states. They are called innate mental states or tendencies, and then you further enhance them. So even for your enlightenment, you don't bring anything from outside sources into your mind. And there is always, and so that is when Buddha explains right effort, what he says is, when he explains right effort, he says that prevent your mind from getting more sinful thoughts. And do everything possible to prevent your mind. Do your effort must be to prevent your mind creating more negative thoughts, negative tendencies. Your efforts must be to cultivate positive tendencies that are already in your mind. So, and if so, it's always prevention and so enhancement, prevention and cultivation. If there are negative ones, you need to remove them, and don't acquire new negative feeling, negative things. And if there are positive things, or positive tendencies already, and you need to identify, so that you need to safeguard them. And at the same time, when during your social behavior, only behave in a way that you can further enhance those positive tendencies. It's always prevention and cultivation is all about our innate mental tendencies. You don't plant anything anew. We were born with the ability, we were born with the potential of awakening. We're born with the potential for turning ourselves into demons or into saints. So we carry both sides. We carry them, how to say, God side and demon side, devil side. Some Western Buddhists call it the monk side and the demon side. Monk and the demon, he said. Once I told one of my professors in Canada, Bhantev, how do you feel about this? I say, I am a monk, but I still have my demon side. So monk with the monk side and demon side both. So I need to work with my demon side to reduce it. Yes, ma'am?
Mara,
exactly. Mara, that's the Buddhist word, Mara. And there can be a whole lesson on Mara too. Mara. We have talked about Mara a lot, but this time we're going to talk about with reference to canonical. And by the way, all these teachings we use in a psychological approach. We use a psychological approach. Now that is the Buddha means the pioneering Buddha. And there's another kind of Buddha. It's called Paccheka Buddhas. P-A-C-C-E-K-A. Paccheka Buddha. While there can be only one pioneering Buddha at a time in the world, there can be as many as like hundreds of Paccheka Buddhas in the world at a time, at any given time. But they don't appear in the world during the realm of Sammasambuddha. During the realm of Sammasambuddha, don't Paccheka Buddhas don't appear in the world. That's a very fascinating story. During before there was one Paccheka Buddha. Oh, by the way, Paccheka means leading one way. If Upananda becomes a Paccheka Buddha, he would still be fully enlightened, but he wouldn't be able to enlighten others about the full Nirvana. The Paccheka Buddhas, they are called, so that they are also known as silent Buddhas. They're silent. Now, the last known Paccheka Buddha's name was Matanga, M-A-T-A-N-G-A, Matanga. M-A-N-M-A-T-A-N-G-A. Matanga. Now there was this Paccheka Buddha by Matanga by name. He heard the next Sammasambuddha, the person, the individual who would become the next Buddha, had now appeared in the world. So he went into a cave and he passed away. He passed away because his time was up, because the Paccheka Buddha is not supposed to live within the realm of a Sammasambuddha. So they always appear When the Buddha realm has ended, Paccheka Buddhas would appear in the world. They could be more than one. And they would simply tour the society. They would walk the society. They wouldn't preach, but they are enlightened. But people only can use them as a merit-making mechanism, I would say. You can make offerings, you can take care of them, but they are unable to enlighten others. So that's why some scholars call them private Buddhas, like private citizens. They are private Buddhas, they are one-way Buddhas, Paccheka. Paccheka means leading one way. So they enlighten themselves, but they can't share, or they can lead others. They can guide others through for enlightenment. So, and there's another one, third type of Buddha. They are called Sutta. S-U-T-A. Sutta. They are called Buddha by listening. Buddha by listening. In order for, like, they are called Arahats in other languages. Arahats or like disciple Buddhas. So this, like, when you talk about different disciples, the Buddha, you have read about disciple monks and nuns from the Buddha's time, right? Well-known ones. But if we use the, but they are called arahats. It's an English word now, the arahat, A-R-H-A-T. You have a Pali word for that too. It's an English word. It's in the dictionary. Arahat. Arahat means somebody who has achieved enlightenment in the company or by listening to, in the company of a Buddha, or by listening to the, by practicing and listening to the teaching of a Buddha. So, unlike the Paccheka Buddhas, Sutta means listen. S-U-T-A, Sutta means one who has listened. Sutta, already done, listening done. Listening done for enlightenment. So you are already enlightened now. So, now, if you try, you can be a Sutta Buddha tomorrow. How? Because Buddha's realm is still there. You have access to the Dhamma. You can practice. So you can become Arahat. And the world is not empty of Sutta Buddhas still. There could be Sutta Buddhas somewhere. There could be enlightened people. By practicing the Buddha, they are called Sutta Buddhas. Buddhas by listening. Sutta again meaning one who has listened. As a result of which, gotten herself enlightened. That's called Sutta Buddhas. So that we use in the canon, we use all these three words to mean enlightened ones. Now, there are how many enlightened? There are three types of enlightened beings. Sambuddha, Paccheka Buddha, Sutta Buddha. Sutta Buddha means arahats. So if you use the three types of enlightened people. So you could be a Sutta Buddha tonight, tomorrow. There could be Sutta Buddhas anywhere. If you say there are no enlightened people in the world, you are wrong. If you say no, prove it. If you say yes, and also, you are kind of wrong, and then prove it. So that we always don't look for proofs. Sometimes all the people ask me, Bhante, can there be arahats or Sutta Buddhas? Yes. Can you prove? I say, no, that's the wrong part of the question. There can be, but I don't know about them. But Buddha says that, even the Buddha is long gone, as long as you practice, as long as practice the path, you can become enlightened. There could be them anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have an unrelated question. Mm-hmm. How many suttas deal with meditation compared to the thousands of suttas that are there?
In fact, there are. I haven't actually determined the number, but the thing is, they are all. They are basically, this is a very fascinating question. You know, Buddha's teachings is divided into three baskets, the Pitakas, suttas, general teachings, Vinaya, rules and regulations for monastics, That specific monastic third basket is Abhidhamma. That's called Buddhist psychology. Most of meditation related teachings are contained in the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Yeah, mostly. Because in the Abhidhamma, you don't talk about individuals. You deconstruct individuality, you only meditate on phenomena. Instead of an individual, you meditate on feelings, sensations, physical body, mind, mentality, all that. So most of, in general, the entire Abhidhamma Pitaka is meditation oriented. And there are so many other teachings, but I think, I wonder whether somebody has counted the meditation related, because most sutras contain meditation related teachings. Any sutra could include part of meditation related teachings. There can be total sutras, sutra totally dedicated to describe meditation, or there could be partial descriptions of meditation. Yeah.
Who are not so the Abhidhamma, the thoughts, they're not, nobody really knows whether it was a Buddha.
Exactly. Actually, the best sutra for out of everything is Satipatthana.
Yeah, so I've heard of that, and but it just seems skewed that such an important thing is not such deeply delved into and for us to be given.
Exactly. Yeah, I get your point. I get your point. They are all over. They are all over. Then you need to make a list of those meditation related sutras. Of course, in meditation classes or retreats, we make a list and we describe. Yeah, in the near future, I'll give you the whole list of them. In fact, they are very simple sutras from the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length sayings. So all the whichever the sutra explains psychological realities are is considered a meditation related sutra. So in general, maybe I use like 5-6 sutras, the most important ones, and that you can easily digest.
Because we hear all these stories about in the suttas. The Buddha comes across somebody, he has a conversation, and miraculously he becomes enlightened. And this happens a lot. But we don't hear so many stories about one spending years meditating and then becoming.
That's true, yeah. Exactly. Excellent, yeah. Actually, I was puzzled by that too for a long time. Because the people who come back and tell the Buddha that they got enlightened wouldn't describe how they practice it. And most of the time Buddha also gives some teachings and he would direct them for meditation. So always the only place that you can see the meditational experience, so is the Theragathas and Therigathas. So that's called the utterances of enlightenment. That's part of the Pali canon by monks and nuns. Theragatha. Gatha means verses. Verses of Thera, monks, and Therigatha, verses of enlightenment by nuns.
But to those people, the journey isn't so.
Yeah, done. It's a done journey. Yeah.
Need something from those between us and the enlightenment.
That's when Buddha said that you need a study with the teacher. And there's a collection of teachers, and that's where the Kammatthana comes into being. Kammatthana, Kammatthana, Kammatthana. Kammatthana means guidance. It's a personalized Kammatthana, because there are some general guidance, the general guidelines in across the sutras, but most of the time Buddha would encourage to have personalized guidance, because meditation techniques must be based on our personality types. That's one key thing that we are supposed to take into consideration, based on our personality type. Because while Buddha has explained general, given general guidelines, most of the time, meditation guidelines must be based on our character type or personality type. For example, say if you are a raga personality, or I mean if you are a lustful personality type, and because your approach to yourself and the world would be too romantic. So then at that point, and you need to reduce that. If you are a hateful character, so if you could be intellectual character, and you have too much devotion, you have too much faith, and you can get misdirected during the practice. So that's why always the best way that we do in Buddhist spirituality is we have a personal interpersonal dialogue with a teacher, and then someone who wouldn't disclose your personal things to someone else, and so that you personally discuss what type of meditation is good for you, and also what type of sutras you must study to have the foundation.
So for that, you need a master. You need to be with a
master
meditator for long enough for them to really know you very well.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. So this all, yes.
All the jhanas not mentioned in the sutra.
They're mentioned. Yeah.
So that would have been
aware. It's been yeah. Yeah. Jhanas are mentioned in different places with sutras. Jhanas, by the way, are the mental psychic absorptions. Jhanas are. Jhanas provide the pure mental space, create pure mental space for you to achieve actual levels of enlightenment. But sometimes there's a risk too. If you get inspired by jhanas too much, you might get settled there. So that you would, and you may not get, you may lose interest in enlightenment, just like it happened to Devadatta, who tried to kill the Buddha. Devadatta had psychic powers because he had achieved jhanas. Because and Buddha said, jhanas could be, you might, jhanas are spiritual advance that everyone is encouraged to, but not everyone is able to achieve jhanas. Some people achieve nirvana through jhanas, psychic ability. And some directly meditate on impermanence and they go through vipassana. There are two ways, two tracks. Could be jhana track or vipassana track.
So the jhanas prepare you for the vipassana?
Exactly, yeah. They prepare you.
So it's not one or the other?
It's one or the other, yeah. So for example, I have never been able to achieve jhana. I have no interest whatsoever. Because all my teachers said, in your past life, so you had zero interest in jhanas. You will always meditate on your skeleton, meditate on impermanence, and you will go through vipassana. And then one teacher read my mind, do you get headache whenever you think about jhanas? Yes, sir, it does. Okay, don't even think about them. Because I have trained, because there are this called emancipation through heart and emancipation through brain. So jhanas are heart-related. So vipassana is more brain related, but they are not clearly identical, two different tracks, because those who go through jhana, they also practice vipassana. Yeah, that's true, yeah, vipassana.
I may be wrong, but I understand this, once you reach the fourth jhana,
yeah,
you can switch over to vipassana.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Enlightenment, yeah, because then upekkha ekam ekagata. Yeah, no, true. Yeah, you have to turn it into vipassana at the fourth level.
The jhanas themselves are just a result, right?
Yeah.
Of meditation practice.
Exactly, yeah.
I know a lot about what the jhanas are.
That's right, yeah. It's
nothingness, all this jhana.
So
there's all these various terms.
So that's when some.
No, until we get there.
Yeah. The once you get.
Isn't so
yeah. So that's the risk. Some people achieve those are called form jhanas, and some people get interested in formless jhanas, and they are the ones who are get reborn into those formless worlds where you get your consciousness frozen for an indefinite period of time, and that's not good. That's a very risk. It is risky. So that is when, once you have jhanas, you have to, as Mr. Amarsekhar said, you have to turn. Then you have to turn, use your jhana, fourth jhana, into vipassana, and you have to meditate on impermanence, because otherwise, jhanas are, you have to see jhanas also as impermanent. Otherwise, you might get too inspired by the jhanas. And so that, and there's no guarantee that you keep the jhanas. They are called worldly jhanas then. Once you become enlightened, your jhanas become permanent jhanas. If I use the layman's language, there's nothing called permanent. Just forget about the philosophical language. Meaning, once, let's say, you achieve jhanas and then you get enlightened, then what happens is you won't lose your jhanas for any reason. And it's like encrypted then. Encrypted jhanas, because you don't have any kilesas or defilements. That's what happened to Devadatta. He had he achieved jhanas, but instead of striving for turning his highest jhana into impermanence and further meditating for enlightenment, he started to playing games with his jhanas. Playing games, he started performing psychic miracles. According to one story, he terrorized, he frightened King Ajatasattu by appearing on his lap as a cobra. And he got terrorized. Please don't do that to me, sir. Okay, then listen to me. So that's how it is. So jhanas. So that's why jhanas are of utmost importance in our spiritual practice. However, we are discouraged to stay there, and we are supposed to turn it into, look at the jhanas as impermanent. Now, and the third, and by the way, you don't have to rush to finish these. We can continue. Any other questions about Buddha? We can discuss the second term next week. Any other questions? It's better to discuss all the questions regarding Buddha or the first one, because we are yet to finish. We haven't done only 10% of this theme today. There's so much more to discuss. So many things.
When you refer to Buddha realm, mm-hmm. it means a period of time. Buddha teachings are still present.
Exactly. Absolutely. Correct. Thank you. That's the best way to. Nothing more to add. That's the perfect definition, description. So you still have access to Buddha realm. So we can still see the Buddha. Philosophically, we say that. And at the same time, some Western Buddhists say, I tried, you know, Bhante, I meditate, I sit myself in front of the Buddha, but I'm yet to see him. Have you seen? I said, no, me neither. And that's the story of Wakkali. Name of a monk. That's I think I can take a few moments to explain that. Wakkali, Wakkali. By the way, we will be very liberal and slow moving here, because we can discuss so many things. We don't have to rush. So always to, whenever I have a question, please ask me. We need to answer that right away, and then only then can we get going. So Wakkali, Wakkali. Wakkali was, he got ordained because he was fascinated by the Buddha's physical appearance. Wakkali. That was his purpose. Now, since he's becoming a monk, he would follow the Buddha wherever the Buddha go. More, let's say, Buddha travels on miles on foot, hundreds of miles maybe. And Venerable Wakkali would know in advance where Buddha would be going. And then all of a sudden, when he would also pop up from his audience. And Buddha would say, and oh, Wakkali, you are here. Yes, sir. And then saw that, and he saw that. Maybe, and Buddha would appear in another, with now talking to another, maybe miles away. And then when he was teaching, Wakkali is there, Wakkali, you are here. Yes, I'm here. Okay. And then so months passed by and Buddha once called him. Why did you become a monk? To get enlightened. So are you working on your enlightenment? Yes. How? Because I am looking at you. So does my appearance have something to do with the enlightenment? Yes, because I'm so fascinated by your radiant appearance. And said, Vakkali, I am no different than yourself. This body is made of flesh, blood and bones. This body is subject to decay and aging. It has nothing to do with your enlightenment. Now, he advised him once. He didn't listen. And once again, he met him somewhere. And he advised him the second time. He wouldn't listen. And he advised one day, months later, he Vakkali came back and he saw him in his audience. Buddha saw him and for the third time he said, Vakkali, unless you get enlightened, you will never ever come back to this audience wherever I go. Now walk away. He asked him to walk away. And he was nowhere to be seen for many months. All of a sudden, he appeared in one monastery. And other monks started teasing him. The unenlightened monks, you know, we also use humor and all this in monasteries, even to these days. You know, we also need a moment of relaxation. So somehow, other monks saw him. And the other monks asked, Vakkali, why did you come here? Don't you follow the Buddha anymore? Are you fed up with following him? Why don't you go? We don't see him. We haven't seen you around. And then he said, well, now I don't have to follow him because I see him wherever I am. And the monks got, some monks got really upset. Huh? You not only followed the Buddha, now you are insulting him. How could a man, an easygoing man like you, claim that you can see him from wherever you are? And they reported it to the Buddha. And the Buddha asked him to appear. And Buddha asked Vakkali to come closer in the company of other monks. And Buddha asked him, Vakkali, is it true that you told your fellow monks that you no longer need to follow the Buddha because you can see him wherever you are? Is that true? Yes, sir, I'm telling the truth. I'm telling the truth. I can see you. And Buddha just closed his eyes and smiled and said, yes, monks, he is telling the truth. Now he is enlightened. Now, before, even though he followed me very frequently, he never saw me. Since he stopped following me, he sees me. Since he stopped following me and he went to meditation, now he can see me everywhere, anywhere. Now that is called the vision of the Buddha. So always the Buddha is identified with enlightenment. Then that completes the definition of Buddha. Because Buddha is not a given name or a last name or a surname. It is a position. When you completely transform your mind and you become enlightened, the position of Buddha, in traditional English you call Buddhahood. Buddhahood or the state of enlightenment. So Buddha represents the state of enlightenment that anyone achieves. So that is when however, in the language is conventional. When you address Gautama the Buddha, you call the Buddha. The Buddha, why? There's only one. Otherwise, you never use definite particle, the, before a name, right? You cannot say the Siddha, you can say the Upananda, because they are given names. You only use a indefinite particle, a or definite particle, the or an, to describe a position or a state. So that's what we call the Buddha, meaning the state of enlightenment. So, and that statement of enlightenment was achieved by Vakkali himself. Now, Vakkali's mind itself is the Buddha. Now he can see. He doesn't come to the Buddha to see him. Why? He is enlightened now. It's like in our like you use a code language. So in certain agencies, companies, you communicate with the code language sometimes. You use codes to communicate, like in security forces and all that. So that in enlightened people, they can communicate with other with one another non-verbally. In fact, when Lakshi's enlightenment, when Upanandi's enlightenment, right? Let's do that. Not today, I'm busy. when we get enlightened, and we don't, when you see each other, we would simply smile with each other, and there would be a topic for us to discuss. Why? What should we talk about? Because we're enlightened. So am I. When the third party coming and asking questions, and then we would talk to him. Or sometimes we can have a dialogue about things, but it's always, there won't be any questions. Venerable Sariputta never asked questions from the Buddha. Venerable Sariputta had no questions to ask. Why? He was enlightened. So that's for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.